From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Thai Army declares martial law but says it's not a coup. China warns of more repercussions over U.S. cyber indictments. Anti-China riot shakes Vietnam's investment prospects. These stories and more in this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Thailand's army has declared martial law and says it will remain in place until peace and order has been restored. As soldiers took up key positions in parts of Bangkok, the military denied it is staging a coup and urged rival political groups to come together and talk. Ron Corbin has more for VOA from Bangkok.
Thailand's Army Chief General Prayut Chan-o-ka says he declared martial law in a bid to end the country's drawn-out political stalemate and prevent violence between pro- and anti-government supporters. In a declaration broadcast on national television, Prayut said the army acted over concerns that the security situation is deteriorating and heavy weapons could be used against civilians. He says the Royal Thai Army intends to bring back peace and order to the country as soon as possible. General Prayut said the military action was not a coup and called on the public to remain calm and go about their normal work. Panattan Mattaniyagorn, a political scientist from Chulalongkorn University, says the military may be hoping to stabilize a volatile and deadlocked political climate amid fears of violence.
The potential violence that are looming quite large. These groups of people are ready to confront each other with arms. I think the military wants to stabilize that. But it's not going to be easy. But of course, I think the military is determined to do that. If they are successful doing that, then secondly, you may open... You may buy time, and open a new space for negotiation. The question is where and in what way negotiation should resume.
Bangkok has endured some 6 months of anti-government protests, pressing the government of former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat to step down. A recent constitutional court found Ms. Yingluck and 9 cabinet members guilty of abuse of power, which led to their resignation. The military says the new caretaker government of Prime Minister Niwathamrong Bunsong Paisan remains in place. The army chief urged both sides of the political divide to come together and discuss a solution. The US State Department released a statement calling on the Thai army to honour its pledge to make this a temporary action to prevent violence and to not undermine democratic institutions. While the Thai army largely stayed out of the political deadlock over recent months, some pro-government leaders, such as senior party member Saman Lutwongrat, see them as sympathetic to the demands of former lawmaker Suthep Thongsaban's anti-government protesters.
I believe that the commander-in-chief of the army is on the side of Khun Suthep. Probably they want to show the Thai people that they are one, everyone into a situation that they can, the political can be calm for just a while.
Since 1932, Thailand has faced 18 coups or coup attempts, the last in 2006 in the overthrow of a former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, accused of abuse of power. Thailand's latest descent into political conflict began in October, following more than 2 years of relative calm under former Prime Minister Ms. Yingluck and her Pheu-Thai party. But street protests erupted over a proposed amnesty bill that opened the way for the return of Thaksin, who fled Thailand in 2008 to avoid a jail term for corruption. New York-based Human Rights Watch says the declaration of martial law Tuesday marks a step back in Thailand's political process. Sunay Pasuk is a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch.
This is very scary, and that's why, for drastic actions such as martial law, there need to be a convincing evidence that the survival of the nation is at risk, or there is out of control public disturbance, something similar to, you know, full scale riots or civil war. Right. But we don't see that. The reasons given by army chief is all speculative.
Sunai says the army's apparent tactic of pressuring conflicting parties to seek a way forward may lead to greater damage for Thailand. Analysts say the army hopes to avoid a repetition of bloodshed in 2010, when clashes with anti-government redshirt protesters left over 90 people dead in the worst bloody violence since 1992. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Later on Daybreak Asia, changing trends among Asian students in the United States. China has lodged a protest with the U.S. ambassador in Beijing in response to accusations that five Chinese military officers engaged in cyber theft and espionage targeting American companies and labor groups. China also says it could take further steps in response to the indictments. VOA's Bill Ide logs in from Beijing.
China's foreign ministry says Beijing lodged the protest late Monday night to U.S. Ambassador Max Baucus, shortly after the indictments were announced. China has flatly denied the accusations and called on the United States to revoke the indictment. Beijing says it is Washington that owes the world an explanation about its own behavior in cyberspace. Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei says that instead of giving an explanation, the U.S. is blurring right and wrong. He says China is demanding that the U.S. give a clear explanation and stop such activities. In the past, the U.S. has accused China of hacking computers to steal everything from military technology to commercial secrets. But the indictments are the first attempt to hold individuals accountable for the crimes. When pressed about whether China engages in cyber hacking on Tuesday, Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei flatly denied the country has ever been involved in the use of cyber theft of trade secrets. He also denied China has ever used hacking against its own people. China says revelations made public by former U.S. intelligence contractor Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks highlight the hypocrisy of the United States when it comes to cybersecurity. In its indictment, the United States alleges the military officers were part of a Chinese military hacking group called Unit 61398. But U.S. officials have been careful to point out that their key concern is the use of hacking to steal commercial secrets to benefit Chinese companies. China's defense ministry has flatly denied the charges and warned the indictments could not only impact an ongoing dialogue over cybersecurity, but military ties as well. Wu Qiang, a political scientist at Beijing's Renmin University, says he finds the indictments baffling. Wu says China and the United States have just started a dialogue on internet security that Washington has been asking for a long time, and Beijing just recently finally agreed to. But now with the indictments, Wu says this has completely destroyed the newly established dialogue. He says that although the United States and China have their own concerns about cybersecurity, those concerns should be handled behind closed doors, not by applying pressure in public. Wu says that in the short term, it will be really hard to even begin holding talks again, adding that this has shut the door on talks altogether. AmCham China Chairman Gregory Gilligan says cybersecurity is a major concern for the business community. In a statement on Tuesday, Gilligan says the group sees a fundamental difference between intelligence gathering for legitimate national security purposes and intelligence gathering for stealing trade secrets. He says the group is urging both governments to reach an agreement on the rules of the road that helps to clarify the difference between the two. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
In Vietnam, businesses affected by last week's deadly anti-China riots are beginning to piece their operations back together. But questions remain over whether any permanent damage has been done to the country's investment prospects over protests that got out of control. Marianne Brown reports from Hanoi.
Vietnam is still reeling from riots which erupted in industrial parks on the outskirts of Ho Chi Minh City and later in central province Ha Tinh, where two Chinese workers were killed and over 100 wounded. The riots broke out following heightened tensions over a Chinese oil rig deployed between Vietnam and the Paracel Islands, which both countries claim. Jerry Shum, Investor Relations Director at Yuyen Industrial Holdings Limited, a sports shoe manufacturer which supplies Nike Incorporated and Adidas, said operations in South Vietnam were now running normally. It will take time before things are back to normal, says Adam Sitkoff, Executive Director of the American Chamber of Commerce in Hanoi. And the business community is encouraging the government to help in a fair and transparent way.
When talking to Taiwanese and Koreans and others, the big issues now are how to handle, I guess, kind of the logistics of getting things back to normal. And that involves some of the technical stuff like wage payments and social and health insurance and stuff in the time period where people weren't working because things were shut down. Who pays for that? How's that handled?
Sitkoff says although the riots have temporarily shaken investor confidence, they will not affect Vietnam's long-term investment prospects. This is partly because the government has made it very clear that this will not happen again, Sitkoff says.
And has done a very effective job at reaching out to key stakeholders and making sure that people understand that their priority is, to continue calm and stability here.
At a news conference on Saturday, Don Yat Huang, director of Vietnam's Bureau for Management of Foreign Investment under the Ministry of Planning and Investment, said Taiwanese companies had been mistaken for Chinese. He said Vietnamese authorities are taking appropriate measures to assist investors in restarting production. However, not everyone is so confident. Economist Vung Quan Hoang, co-author of What We See, Why We Worry, Why We Hope, Vietnam Going Forward, says he believes investors will keep a wait-and-see attitude for some time. He said part of the problem is that the government's decision-making process on this issue is not clear from the outside, and analysts are left to speculate.
I don't know whether such a political will be able to make things happen the way politicians and leaders want. Because apparently they didn't want to see the riots and the kind of devastating effect we've been seeing over the past week, right? Nobody wanted that. Nobody wanted that.
The crisis could also lead to changes within the country. Some observers have said anti-China protests sparked riots among factory workers because of grievances over poor working and living conditions. Sitkoff says the current environment is a good opportunity for Vietnam to make itself even more attractive to foreign business and undertake some of the reforms that have been necessary for a long time to make the country more competitive. The Vietnamese government feels bad, he says, and it wants people to come back. This is Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
You may share this and our other stories from our VOA Asia Facebook page. It's a popular place to check out online. Stop by and be sure to like us. Next year marks the 150th anniversary of when large numbers of Chinese started working on the Transcontinental Railroad in the United States. Very little is known about these workers' lives and what happened to them after the construction ended. Stanford University is working on a project to piece together the lives of the Chinese railroad workers by reaching out to their descendants. Elizabeth Lee has more from Los Angeles.
Desperation and courage could very well describe what led Bill Yee's ancestors to come to the United States.
I don't think I could do it, to come to a strange country and don't know a word of English. But I guess it's between eating or starving. I guess you have to do what you have to do for your family.
His ancestors came from southern China. They became a part of key moments in American history.
My great-grandfather came over during the gold rush days. And he returned back to China as a wealthy man. And then my great-grandfather came over to work on the railroad. He came over as to work in with black gunpowder, black powder, and on the railroad, and he died working on the railroad.
But that didn't stop his grandfather from coming to the U.S. on false papers. He ran a laundry, and his father continued that business.
Things were pretty bad in the southern part of China at that time. So they came to America at all costs.
Shelley Fisher Fishkin wants to hear stories like Yi's.
The records of specific individuals and their names and experiences are so sparse.
Fishkin is co-director of the Chinese Railroad Workers in North America project at Stanford University. She is working with scholars in Asia to look for descendants of railroad workers on both continents to reconstruct the lives of these men.
Many of the Chinese workers who came to work on the Transcontinental and other railroads returned to China after their work was done, created families there. Some of them had families who they left when they came here, and they may have descendants in China.
The aim is to create a digital archive of artifacts, documents, and oral histories from the railroad workers' descendants so historians can piece together the mystery of who they were and what happened to them.
And the U.S. could not have become the modern industrial nation that it did without the railroads. And the railroads would not have come together when they did without the crucial work of these Chinese workers.
Jonathan Wong's ancestor knew English and left China to work as a translator on the Transcontinental Railroad. He eventually brought his family to the U.S., and they settled in San Francisco.
He kind of had a different experience than actually having to do labor. He wouldn't go home feeling that he was going to be in danger the next day. It was more of a closer relationship, obviously, with the white community and his white superiors. But obviously, I know that he was still treated as if he was the inferior minority.
Shelley Fisher Fishkin says it was a part of life as a Chinese railroad worker.
They suffered greatly from discrimination and from prejudice. They were paid less than their Euro-American workers.
Bill Yi wants his 6 children and 19 grandchildren to know their family history.
They had to appreciate the sacrifice that our grandparents did for us. Otherwise, I might be working in the rice fields now. So it really bring a big opportunity to this generation.
Through the Stanford University project, the lives of these men can be remembered, so the role they played in American history will be remembered by their descendants. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Daybreak Asia comes to you each morning, Monday through Friday. We appreciate you starting your day with us. It's Wednesday, and that's when Daybreak Asia looks at higher education in Asia and the United States. For many years, the number of international students applying to and attending graduate schools here in the United States has been growing. Most of those students have been coming from China. In fact, students from China now make up a full 1/3 of all international students enrolled at U.S. graduate schools. Students from India come in at number 2 on that list, but that trend seems to be changing. Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman spoke about the situation with Deborah Stewart, the president of the organization that carries out the studies, the Washington, D.C.-based Council of Graduate Schools.
What we saw in this last report is that while international applicants to U.S. graduate schools have increased overall by 7% for the coming fall, the numbers are up dramatically from India, up 32%. Over last year, and last year was way up over the year before. On China, on the other hand, we're looking at a decline. Last year we had a 5% decline in Chinese applications, and this year a 1%. And that comes on the heels of a 5, 6, 7 year set of double-digit increases from China year over year. Then suddenly last year, applications were down 3%, and then this year down again 1%.
What's going on?
really tough to know. What is pretty clear is that China has made many investments in building strong graduate programs in recent years. And at some point, it's quite reasonable to expect some proportion of talented Chinese students to be applying to those programs. But for the top Chinese students, all the evidence that we have is that U.S. is still the country of choice. Remember, we get a huge number of applications from China. So the fact that we're down 1% this year over last year, or even that last year we were down 3% over the year before, does not mean that we still don't have a very large number of very attractive applicants from China.
Could there be any input by the fact that many U.S. colleges and universities are opening not only undergraduate but graduate facilities inside China?
Certainly, that could be a factor. I think the more likely explanation is that China itself is opening many, many more spaces in strong graduate programs and has done so over a number of years in recent years. Up until about six or seven years ago, we produced more Chinese PhDs in the United States than China did. But then the lines crossed about 6 or 7 years ago, and this year there are many, many, many more PhDs produced in China who are Chinese than we produce in the United States. That's how it should be, and it's a good thing that China is developing strong graduate programs. It's also true that American universities are opening up graduate programs and largely undergraduate programs in China, but those numbers pale by comparison to the numbers of slots open for graduate study within Chinese universities themselves.
And just to be clear, this report, this survey does apply only to graduate students, not undergraduate, right?
Only to graduate students. And again, I think it's very important to stress, especially when I talk to international audiences, that international students are vitally important to U.S. graduate education and research. The United States remains the country of choice for the vast majority of students who pursue graduate study outside of their home countries. But today, we end up with a situation where we have many more applicants to our graduate programs than we can accept. These young people need to go to graduate school somewhere, so it's a good thing that there are many good options opening around the world. My concern is that we just be able to continue to attract some of the most talented students, whether they're coming from China or India or South Korea or Taiwan.
We have talked about China. What about India?
India has been up and down and up and down for many years. What is the big story about India is that this is the second year of a huge increase in applications. Clearly, Indian students have long recognized the value of a U.S. degree. But it's true that the Indian economy is now experiencing some challenges. Middle-class growth has slowed, and many Indian students recognize that the best thing to do when that's happening in your economy is to strengthen your credentials. And the best way for them to do that is by pursuing a U.S. degree.
Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Deborah Stewart, the president of the Council of Graduate Schools. Well, education never stops as you continue to live. In fact, you learn something new every day. Learn about the latest world news next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this app,